where, shall I say, the odd jingle. You know, I turn down a lot more work than I used to. I don't have a regular job, and I just try to do enough, try to monitor it, so I'll have enough money coming in to, you know, not
pay
have
the bills.
To move. Yeah, and it's a little touchy sometimes, but it's a good feeling to know that the other music is so important that everything has to fall in line behind that, and that's what I have to think about when I start panicking about money. I mean, most of the people that have been doing this never had the luxury of having a day job like Jingles that paid for everything.
Now, for people who don't know, and at this point I can't imagine that there are many, but David is one of the most successful jingle writers of the last decade, certainly.
Oh, thank
with,
you.
With recognizable melodies on the airwaves all the time.
Well, it was a very strange thing. I just kind of fell into it.
Did you wake up one morning and decide?
I wanted a job. This was, you know, like 10 years ago, and I'd been struggling for 10 years before that as a singer-songwriter. Had some good years, have some bad years, but I was at a point where I wanted a little more stability, and that was one of several things I was planning on trying. It worked out. I mean, it's funny. I mean, I don't think I write jingles a lot. Particularly that much better than I write songs, but it was as hard as it's been, you know, to establish myself as a songwriter or a singer or whatever. That's how easy it seemed to be to get into the jingle business.
Is the mental process different? Is your mind working?
Yeah, you
got to
think short.
Well, for 15 sure.
15 seconds, say it and get out of there.
Right, that's true.
It's all craft. I mean, the big difference, of course, is that they tell you what to write about, and frequently they tell you what to say about it, and then you have to figure out a way to make that attractive to yourself and an audience musically. It's music in the service of another goal. I mean, when I write a song about a subject that I'm interested in, it's music in the service of that subject. I mean, it's, you know, I'm
right.
trying to craft a piece of communication, but I'm not as limited in ways and means.
No, I understand. Now, I'm guessing that when it was decided that the duo was over and you would be resuming a solo career, that there were a combination of emotions. On one level, I think it was probably a little scary. On another mm-hmm. level, I think it was probably kind of liberating.
Yeah,
is
but
that
right on
right?
both.
And
right. Yeah, I was. I went through a period of being really just wildly despondent about it because it was like a death in the family. And finally, I said, "Well, if I'm going to do this, I better get on with it and see if it's going to be possible." And I spent most of last summer just sitting home writing and trying some new things and, you know, different tunings and different, you know, just different ideas. And I wrote, I would say, two or three songs for every one I kept. And I put a show together and got the guys together, and we did some gigs out of town, and then we brought it into the Bottom Line last fall, and it worked great.
That's right. You got custody of the players.
Well, actually, it wasn't contested.
We should, in fact, credit your musicians today.
Absolutely. That was Marshall Rosenberg on percussion and Paul Gazzone on bass. Actually, on that tune, it was mostly the guys grunting and singing, but the band is Marshall, Paul, Erwin Fish on keyboards, and Joey Minona on saxophone, and a bunch of other things.
And our listeners are going to get a chance to see you real soon.
Oh, yeah. Friday the 13th.
Are you superstitious, my friend?
I picked that date because I figured at least I would remember it. Friday the 13th at the Bottom Line. And I want to say a word about the opening act on that evening, because that was one of the reasons I was motivated to go back and do this, was Alan Pepper at the Bottom Line did a sort of a two-night, six-act-a-night, I think he called it opening acts
yes.
show
yes.
last fall. No, it was about 3 months ago,
right.
maybe, in the wintertime. And I had heard, there was, everybody was terrific. I saw one night, and I saw six great acts. And Patty Larkin was on that night, and David Wilcox. But the act I had specifically come to see, because I had heard their album, was a duo called Story. Two women from Boston who... they recorded an album on Green Linnet, which I understand is being picked up by Elektra. But I just loved the record. I thought it was just masterful. I just fell in love with it and them, and I wanted to see what they did live. And they came out, the two of them, without their band, and just were sensational. And so I said to Alan, let's do a show, because I think my people would really love them.
Do you do stuff together as well? Or?
Well, we haven't worked anything up, but, you know, if we have time during the sound check, maybe. Yeah.
Okay, that's David Buskin and The Story at the mm-hmm. Bottom Line on Friday, March 13th.
That's right.
Material, how much were you able to use from the B&B days, and how much is new?
Well, this jacket is kind of a mix. It's I tried... There's one night. There's a piece right there. I tried to... at first, I was going to just say, well, I'm not going to use any of the old song. I write all new. And then gradually, I let a couple of tunes creep back in because I knew people would be asking for them and because they were just too good to lose, you know, ESPN and some of the silly stuff. And,
sure. And some of the serious stuff, too, which actually leads us to the next song. Because this,
right, this is
one that that I saw you do live with Christine at the Bottom Line, I guess a couple of years ago.
Oh, yeah.
The three-night stand?
Oh, yeah, I remember. Right? Four nights, actually.
Four nights.
Yeah, that was great.
And then it popped up on her compilation.
The Winter,
Winter's Night.
Yeah. And but this version, actually, is a little bit more produced because... I wanted to see really what would happen if we tried to take what I had written as a very simple little folk song and expand it acoustically. And David Wolfert produced a version of this with the aforementioned people, or some of them anyway, and also Michael Daw on drums. And this is what came out.
Let's give it a listen. It's called Words That Bring the Tear.
That's
on
right.
The Sunday Show at 92.3 K-Rock.
Be into the wind, but you somehow make my worrying absurd. connection to where all songs begin, and I hope I've got a few you haven't heard. How did one so young become so wise? I think you opened up my eyes. And if you and I go wandering down the days imagining, we will find the things that we hold dear. This time of year, like the birds that never go, like the first star to appear, like the coming of the dawn, like the running of the deer, like love's old sweet song.
At 92.3 K-Rock, that is David Buskin and a new version of Words That Bring the Tear, a song you might be familiar with from its appearance on the Christine Lavin anthology On a Winter's Night. This is Pete Fornatel with my special guest this morning, David Buskin, who will be at the Bottom Line for two shows on Friday, March 13th with The Story.
That's right.
David, what is the game plan? What, you know, if you could sit down and map it out now, you've been doing it as a solo for almost a year. What are you going to, how are you going to pursue it differently than in the duo days?
Well, beats me.
what do you want to happen?
Well, what I would love to do, I think the next thing obviously to do is to make a record. Now that I've written... I never have all the songs that I want. It's never right, it's just better, you know. It's like I'm always on the way. But I have a body of material that I think holds together, and I'd like to make a record. And I'd like to make a record for more money than I have myself, so that I have to find the money either from a record company or from an alternative source, and do that, and then get it distributed, and then just continue to do what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
The only difference between the... approach now is really that I am spending more time at it, so I hope I won't take as long about it.
What made you want to do this originally? Can you bring us back?
I've agonized about that. I don't know. I mean, I certainly wasn't a teenager thinking, boy, I can't wait to grow up and get into advertising and do jingles. playing in bands and loving the music when we were kids, and the same thing that made you a music junkie.
Who are your heroes?
Well, the people that we used to love when we played in the high school bands were Chuck Berry and Buddy Holly and Fats Domino.
Where is this, David? Where are we?
In New York. I grew up in the Bronx.
Okay.
And, you know, that's the stuff we were hearing on the radio. That's the stuff we loved. The stuff Alan Freed was playing.
And
the folk stuff, actually, I didn't get into until later. I mean, I think it was like my senior year in high school when folk music for a minute became a commercial hot property. And Peter, Paul, and Mary, and then Bob Dylan, and Joan Baez, Tom Rush. Boy, Tom is old, isn't he?
You've worked with him considerably.
Oh, yeah. That was one of the nice things about my career is that I got to work with these people that got me inspired to get into the business.
Great.
I mean, there's all stuff like that happening all the time. Like in my senior prom in high school, we went to the Copacabana and saw Johnny Mathis. And then like 20 years later, he cut a song of mine. And I don't know why that felt so, like, so delightful, but it did.
Yeah, I call it payback. You know,
yeah.
There are these people that touched you at a certain point, mm-hmm. and you never forget it. And you always want to, in some way or another, pay back.
Well, when I've written with people or played in their bands, like Judy Collins, or when I first played with Mary Travers, and she's sitting there asking me if I know the chords to Blowin' in the Wind. Well, yeah, I think I can find my way through that. Yeah. It was great. And then writing with Judy and hearing her sing, you know, every now and then she just break into a song from the old days. I said, Judy, would you sing Suzanne? You know, that's great.
Now, you and Robin worked with Judy as
the... Yeah, we wrote a whole bunch of songs. Yeah, we'll probably write. We'll probably do some more writing, yeah.
Super.
Yeah, that's probably going to happen.
You've been at this a long time now, so, you know, I don't think you're going into it naively.
Mm-hmm.
How have your goals changed? How have your ambitions changed?
That's a good question, actually. I think I'm a little more settled about it now. I think that, first of all, you know, the business has changed and the way people go about doing this. I mean, everybody has technology, or at least accessible, if not in their living room. Many people can make their own records and even distribute them and sell them off the back of the truck at concerts. And mm-hmm. you can, in some ways it's easier, in some ways it's harder, because big time playlist, small playlist radio is not accessible to artists like me, unless lightning strikes, you know, which happens every once in a while. But probably I'm going to have to find a way to get to my audience, presuming that they're there, which I do. And, I mean, Christine is a good example. Christine works very hard, and she's very inventive in the ways that she finds. She puts together these compilation albums. She does these, you know, combo tours with different artists. And any way that you can do it to get up on a stage and have people able to come and see you, and then try to find a way to spread that.
Well, you know how I feel about it. If there is any justice in this world, you will be talking to a much larger audience, or an audience equal to the one that you talk to in your short songs with your longer stuff.
Yeah, thanks, Pete.
Is there something else you can do for us this morning?
Yeah, this is. I'd like to end the segment with this song. It's called Goodwill.
It's the sweetest thing you gave us. Goodwill, don't you know it's we're gonna live together, we better make this house a home. Oh, make this house a
song music marathons mean the most music on 92.3 K-Rock, WXRK New York, Howard Stern all morning, classic rock and roll all day.
At 92.3 K-Rock, we're giving away highly valued tickets to see the Grateful Dead and their sold-out shows every time we play the Dead this weekend. This is Pete Fornital on the Sunday show. James Taylor will be celebrating his 44th birthday on March 12th, which coincidentally is also the night of his appearance at our Rainforest benefit at Carnegie Hall. Now, one of my favorite visits of all of last year was when James came up in October to talk about his recent New Moonshine album. We're going to reprise that visit with James, beginning right after these messages.
Hello, young people of Westchester and All Points Suburban. Are you tired of spending every weekend circling the same old mall, seeing the same faces go by? Do you feel trapped with nothing to do when you and your friends are without a car? Hop on a train, a Metro North train right into Grand Central for a big-time day in the Big Apple. Shop in Greenwich Village, where the wild and way out are always in. Experience the exotic tastes of Chinatown and Little Italy. Get in tune with tunes you'll never find in suburban record stores. To get your day off to a fast start, Metro North whizzes you into Manhattan at speeds up to 90 miles an hour. So if you've had enough of the suburban scene, young people, check out New York on Metro North.
With Metro North's low off-peak weekend fares, you save 25% off regular fares. Metro North, the best road is the railroad.
She tied on her first pair of ice skates at the age of 2. At 10, she developed the explosive stride that would sear the ice from Sarajevo to Calgary. Now, after more than 15 years of determination, U.S. Olympic team speed skater Bonnie Blair is the fastest in the world. It's the journey that makes Bonnie the best. And along the way, she replenishes her body every day with Evian Natural Spring Water. It begins as a drop of rain or snow, making its own journey deep within the French Alps. After 15 years, enriched by the mountains, it emerges pure and balanced, a drop of Evian. Perfection never happens overnight. To be the best takes time. Evian, proud sponsor of the 1992 U.S. Olympic team.
It's a construction nightmare. At world-famous Plaza Honda Acura Olds in Brooklyn, we're jammed with over 1,700 cars that we bought before the March 1st price increase. And with showroom construction going on, we've just got to move them off the lot now. So for the first time ever, Plaza is forced to offer its preferential employee prices to the public. Even our own sales manager couldn't buy any of these vehicles for less. What more can we do to interest you? No down payment? You've got it. No payment till summer? Okay. Financing as low as 2.9 APR and up to $2,000 cash back on selected models? You've got it all at Plaza Honda Acura Olds, 2740 Nostrand Avenue in Brooklyn. We'll even pay off your trade no matter how much you owe. Remember, for a limited time only, you can beat the March 1st factory price increase and get the same preferential prices we give to our own employees here at the world-famous Plaza Honda Acura Old Supercenter. Come to 2740 Nostrand Avenue, Brooklyn. Help us clear them out. Save hundreds, even thousands of dollars.
Should talking long distance feel any different than talking in person? We don't think so. We think you should be able to call anyone, anywhere, anytime, and still save money. That's why we invented the new AT&T Any Hour Saver Plan. Only $10 for an hour of state-to-state direct dial calls anytime. Then bonus prices of only 11 cents a minute after 5 and on weekends. Because how you talk is your business. Making it more affordable is ours. AT&T. Available in most areas. Actual savings may vary.
This is Pete Fornital back with you at 92.3 K-Rock with my special guest today, James Taylor.
Hi, Pete.
Well, the secret of life is enjoying the passage of time. Any fool can do it. There ain't nothing to it. Nobody knows how we got to the top of the hill. But since we're on our way down, we might as well enjoy the ride. The secret of love is in opening up your heart. It's okay to feel afraid, but don't let it stand in your way. No, no, 'cause everyone knows that love is the only road. And since we're only here for a while, we might as well show some style. Give us a smile now, isn't it a lovely ride? Sliding down and gliding down. Try not to try too hard, it's just a lovely ride. Now the thing about time is that time isn't really real. It's all your point of view. How does it feel for you? Einstein said that he could never understand it all. Planets spinning through space, the smile upon your face. Welcome to the human race. And some kind of lovely ride. Oh, sliding down and gliding down. Try not to try too hard, it's just a lovely ride. Some kind of lovely ride. Oh yeah, now. Sliding down and gliding down and try not to try too hard, it's just a lovely ride. Now the secret life is enjoying the passage of time.
That has always been one of my favorite songs of yours, James.
Thank you, Pete.
It's such a wise and calm little song, but if I can place it back in time, it probably came in a period of turmoil for you, yes?
I suppose relatively. I remember the actual occasion of writing it, which was I was at a friend's house that was under construction, and I was living in a tent on their property. And it was a sort of a sunny summer day, very pleasant time, and I was sitting on these a stairwell that they were building that was just a, you know, open stairwell, staircase, sort of, and that song just crystallized out of that morning. It was a very fast thing to write. It really took no time at all. And though it may have been a time of a lot of turmoil, that particular morning was awful nice, I seem to remember.
Well, it's always been part of your magic to be able to do that, even going back to Fire and Rain, which is a very calming song about a very disturbing incident.
Well, you know, I think a lot of these songs, you know, they're written for very personal reasons, and to do something for me, you know, sort of a remedial kind of a thing. I think that's how I started writing, and it probably is to a large extent still where I write from. So, you know, they're sort of meant to be reassuring to me, or to help me with, in some cases, help me with, some of them are celebratory, but a lot of them are to help me with a difficulty or a hard time or something. So.
By extension, they become comforting and reassuring to other people. Are you surprised at the interpretations that your audience makes of your music or specific songs sometimes?
Yeah, although I can't think of any exact episodes. I have been, you know, sometimes you read a lyric translated back from a foreign translation of the song, and it's like playing telephone, you know, you get a a really wide sort of a wide swinging kind of interpretation of what it might have been, but no, I can't actually think of being surprised by how people interpreted the songs. People are usually pretty much on. Sometimes it's surprising, gratifying, and surprising to see how much they mean to people, and how much, you know. People tell me often that they've been impacted a lot by my stuff, and that it's meant a lot to them, and that's a great thing to hear.
Are you comfortable with that? Are you comfortable with your celebrity?
I think I'm pretty comfortable with the level of it now. Yeah, I am. I mean, celebrity is a weird thing, and I think it's you know, I've spoken about it and actually written in a couple of songs like "That's Why I'm Here" and stuff, and other songs like it. I've written and "Hey Mister, That's Me" up on the jukebox and stuff about how odd it is to sort of be me and to find that I'm sort of a publicly private person. You know, there are very strange things about it, and there are also just strange things about the phenomenon of celebrity, of people being interested in somebody because people are interested in somebody, you know, because it just sort of accrues a kind of gravitational pull after a while, you know. Mm-hmm. Enough people sort of focus on someone and suddenly people are focusing on them because all these people are focusing on
right.
them. So,
right.
You know, you know, it's a media phenomenon that people think they have an actual personal connection with somebody who, you know, who they experience through the media. And I think often that can be maybe a mistake, you know, because that's not a direct and really whole relationship. But I don't want to get on my high horse or seem too heavy about it. I think that generally speaking, my celebrity is at a level, and the people who are interested in my stuff are themselves of a level to make it very comfortable for me, you know?
That's great.
Yeah,
that
it is
great. There's a book about this by Richard Schickel called Intimate Strangers, which is exactly what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Media personalities are, in a very strange way, intimate strangers. We're doing it right now, James. You tend to forget it, but the fact is that there are microphones and tape recorders here that will put this, you know, through an antenna somewhere and into people's homes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if they want to hear it, they can always dial it out.
Absolutely.
But don't know that. Please don't cut us off here.
Person to person and man to man, I'm back in touch with my long lost friend. Listen to reason and understand, and think of me from way back when. Said me and Melissa, well, we fell out of love, ran out of luck, seems like the lightning struck. I've been thinking of leaving, but I can't raise a buck. James, I'm wondering, could I borrow your truck? I say, that's why I'm here.
That's why I'm here.
Got no better reason. That's why I'm standing before you.
That's why I'm here.
That's why I'm. He dies high, he's brown red. Later said to have drowned in his bed. After the laughter, the wave of dread, it hits us like a ton of lead. It seems learn not to burn means to turn on a dime. Walk on if you're walking, even if it's an uphill climb. Try to remember that working's no crime. Just don't let them take your waste of time. That's why I'm here.
That's why I'm here.
There'll be no more message tonight. That's why I'm here.
That's why I'm here.
Oh, that's why I'm here. This is an IOU. I reckon I owe you one now. Listen, Wendy, listen, Glory. This'll
my name. Pay good money, take your fire and rain. Again and again and again. Oh, summer like summer, coming back every year. Got your baby, got your blanket, got your bucket of beer. I break into a grin from ear to ear, and suddenly it's perfectly clear. That's why I,
new album. It's been 3 years.
Yes.
Since the last time around with Never Die Young. How do you approach making a record these days, James? What is the process? Why don't you take us from the point of Never Die Young in 88 to New Moonshine in 91?
Okay, well we did, we actually recorded Never Die Young in 87, but we turned it in so late that the record company thought it best to hold it off until an 88, early 88 release. As I remember it now, we toured with the album a little bit. After it comes out, you tour with it some. We did that summer. That was the summer of 88. The summer of 89, we didn't work, and for some reason I didn't write, although I suppose writing is a very, you know, it's such a subliminal process for me that it's so unconscious that I'm sure that things were sort of bubbling along. So I had thought that in the late spring of 90, I thought I should go back in the studio again, and I booked some time, and I went in on my own with a couple of songs I had that are now on this record, and just put down guitar tracks with drum machine, and then I redid the guitar and redid the vocal on it, and I thought that's a way that people record these days, and I thought I would layer the thing up, add things to it, manipulate them, have a lot of control over it. But, you know, it didn't really work out, and that was sort of a false start. Well, I booked a tour. I had already booked a tour that I had hoped would come out, that I would be on after the album came out, but in fact, I mothballed the album, and we went out on the road. We did about 3 months. After the tour was over, I said to Don Grolnick, I said, listen, let's go back in the studio this coming spring. And he and I started doing what we had done the album before. He would get together with me to start with once every 2 weeks, every 3 weeks, once a month, throughout the winter, up until about New Year's. And we'd go over the stuff. He'd play them on piano with me. I'd play them for him on guitar, and he'd work out a piano arrangement, and we'd talk about how to do them and how they were feeling. You know, he'd listen to things that I was sort of starting and say, yeah, that sounds promising, or he'd say, well, you know, maybe we've got one that sounds like that already. Maybe we should focus on this. So we would go back and forth and talk musically about the material. Then after New Year's, we stepped that process up. We booked time in April, and I hid myself away for a couple of months up in Connecticut near where I live. And he would come up once a week, and we'd work on the stuff. So it started to have a real... by the time we went into rehearsals with the band, we called the same band together that had been out on the road. By the time we went in rehearsals with that, we were really in good shape. We had about six songs finished, and the rest of the songs in good enough shape to be able to do tracks on them.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's the same kind of... formula that we followed the album before, me and Don getting together, working up the arrangements, talking about the stuff, you know, meeting infrequently at the start and then getting more intense as we come down to it, rehearsing everything with the band, you know, knowing what we've got, and then basically going in and making what turns out to be an old-fashioned type of recording session, which is to have pretty much everybody playing who's going to be on the record. Very, very few overdubs. A solo here, a little a little accent there, you know, some vocal harmonies here and there, and touching up things in various ways, but basically sort of a live technique of recording.
You're not the kind then that writes 30 songs and then chooses 12 from that. Do you have a lot of stuff on the shelf, or
no? You know, things I have things in progress that I haven't finished yet. But generally speaking, I shelve them before they're finished if they're not going to make it. You know, I know it, and I don't like them. You know, so
what is Copperline?
I lived in a hilly portion of North Carolina, and there was a creek that ran between these two sort of large hills that were in my immediate vicinity when I grew up. And down that creek, which is called Morgan Creek, was a quarry, like a stone quarry, with these sort of... it was just construction stone, you know, crushed rock, and... but it was... It had a sort of a sheen to it. It looked like I don't know why it's called Copperline, and the song says I don't know why it's called Copperline, but that's what we used to call it down there, is Copperline.
What brought it to mind?
You know, it just came out. I was sitting backstage in Los Angeles, warming my voice up to do a job. I was playing the guitar and just following the chords around. Out comes this thing about down on Copperline. You know, I don't know where it comes from, you know. It's just a visitation of some sort. Really, it's like the song Carolina says, which is actually a lot like it, sort of. It's like a friend of yours that hits you from behind, you know. It sort of just sneaks up on you, and hey.
It's a real good song. Let's listen on the Sunday show at 92.3 K-Rock.
Ever I took, like a page from a romance book, the sky opened and the earth shook, down on Copperline, down on Copperline. Took a fall from a windy height, I only knew how to hold on tight. Pray for love enough to last all night, down on Copperline. Day breaks and the boy wakes up, and the dog barks and the bird sings, and the sap rises and the angel sighs. Yeah. I tried to go back as if I could, all spec house and plywood, tore up good. Down on Copperline, it doesn't come as a surprise to me. It doesn't
drifting up, rising free, down over Copper Line. Half a mile down to Morgan Creek, I'm only living for the end of the week. The gillies and a hog-nosed snake, down on Copper Line, yeah. Take me down on Copper Line.
At 92.3 K-Rock, that is Copper Line from the brand new New Moonshine album by my special guest this morning, James Taylor. We'll be back with more after these words.
After this.
Beatlefest 92, the 22nd official Beatles celebration, returns to the New Jersey Meadowlands Hilton Hotel for one very exciting weekend, March 13th, 14th, and 15th. Beatles fans will come together to enjoy nonstop Beatles movies, rare concert films and videos, a giant international Beatles flea market, auctions of Beatles memorabilia, a Beatles museum, recording studio, and video sing-alongs. Meet very special guests, world-renowned singer-songwriter Harry Nilsson, and former general manager of Apple, Alistair Taylor. Plus, Liverpool, the finest Beatles sound-alike band in America, will be live in concert each evening, and there's so much more. I'm Jimmy Fink, and I'll be your host. Don't miss Beatlefest 92 New York Metro at the New Jersey Meadowlands Hilton Hotel Friday evening and all day Saturday and Sunday, March 13th, 14th, and 15th. Tickets now on sale at all Ticketmaster locations. For more information or to charge tickets by phone, call toll-free 1-800-BEATLES. That's Beatlefest, 1-800-BEATLES.
On any day, you can hear a lot of the reasons why Long Island is an attractive place to live and do business. And at Lilco, we've begun a program that gives companies more sound reasons to move to Long Island. Our economic development program makes it easy for businesses to expand or move here. And we're offering discounted rates to relocating or expanding companies that participate in Lilco's conservation programs. It's a good deal for businesses because they get reduced energy bills. It's a good deal for Long Island because we get more jobs. Lilco's economic development program boosts the Long Island economy, and by encouraging energy conservation, it helps preserve the environment.
If you're thinking about expanding or moving your business, give the people at Lilco a call. The number is 800-692-2626. That's 800-692-2626. The people at Lilco, working harder to serve you better.
Tremendous excitement here in Olympic Arena, Harry, where the big hockey game...
Excuse me, George, but the hockey players are coming off the ice.
What?
Yeah, they're climbing into the stands, gathering around a fan who's scratching a New Jersey lottery ticket.
Well, that's the darndest thing, a lottery ticket?
Yeah, George, it's Winning Spirit, the new Olympic scratch-off game from the New Jersey Lottery. For just a buck, he could win $25,000.
$25,000? Wow! Can you see what he's doing?
Well, it looks really fun. He scratches off the Olympic rings on the Winning Spirit game card, then he adds up the medals to see if he's won.
This crowd is really come alive.
Shh, he's going for the 25,000. Still scratching. And yes, he wins it all. The whole enchilada.
And the money.
Play Winning Spirit. It's the only Olympic game held in New Jersey this year. Win $25,000 in an instant. Winning Spirit. Scratch it. Catch it. Now at your New Jersey lottery agent.
Players are carrying him off on their shoulders. And Harry, wait. Harry, where are you going?
To New Jersey to play Winning Spirit.
More and more people are discovering the Wall Street Journal Guide to Understanding Money and Markets, a remarkable 120-page book which explains the terms and techniques of finance. It retails for $13.95, but it's yours free with your paid subscription to the Wall Street Journal. Call now and you can have 13 weeks of the Wall Street Journal and the valuable 120-page guide, all for only $37. Call now toll-free in the continental U.S., 800-521-0200. That's 800-521-0200.
This is Pete Fornital back with you on the Sunday show with my special guest this morning, James Taylor. I had just mentioned the title of the album as we went into that break, James, and it reminded me of that standard question, why New Moonshine?
Well, you know, I like it's in that song Copper Line. It talks about branch water and tomato wine, creosote and turpentine, sour mash and new moonshine down on Copper Line. And
New Moonshine to me, I sort of make lists of things that might, that the album might be called, you know. I mean, on that list were Life Along the River, Hercules and a Hog-Nosed Snake, you know, a lot of different things. But New Moonshine kind of, to me, it's a contradiction, you know. It's sort of dark. Because, you know, there is no light from a new moon. It's completely dark. But I liked the idea of there being new moonshine, you know. And that, and the other thing that it says is that it's new moonshine, like a different kind of moonshine, you know, sort of. Mm-hmm. And moonshine and the moon and the sun and a couple of other simple elemental things keep surfacing in my lyrics, so... I don't know, it just seemed good, you know. It seemed concise, and the album also has to me kind of a side to it that it seemed to indicate both sides of it, the sort of bright side of it and the sort of dark side of it too. Like a tune like Down in the Hole is really, you know, I mean, it's an up-tempo tune, but it's dark, you know.
Right, right. But on the other side of that coin, there's the one that just jumped out at me the first time through, and in fact its light side is expressed in the title, Shed a Little Light. What can you tell me about that one?
Well, I wrote that song on the keyboard. It has a, you know, it's a very symmetrical song. It starts and ends with the same section, and then right after the beginning of it is that sort of ascending line thing where there's a feeling like the clenching of a fist. That mm-hmm. that part of it goes, that happens just after the introduction and just before the ending. And then there's a section in the middle that is also composed in a very symmetrical way. So it's sort of like the song runs to the middle and it reverses itself and ends. It's a very sort of wide open song. It really is sort of exposed in a sense. Sometimes I feel uneasy about, I mean, it's a little bit like a cartoon in that it's sort of like a seventh grade paper on peace and brotherhood. You know, it's just very matter of fact and very, in ways, very naive, you know.
It's right up front, right out there. No no double meaning here.
Yes, that's right. And I think so. And I've, I occasionally have, in the recording of it and thinking about it and trying to place it on the record and stuff, I went back and forth from feeling as though, well, this is great, and I'm really feel terrific about this, and also, but sometimes feeling uneasy about it, and saying, well, you know, this is just it's too naive. I'm, you know, what, you know, what's this white guy, middle class white guy, saying about Martin Luther King, you know? But the fact is, when I grew up in the South in North Carolina, Martin Luther King was for me, certainly for a lot of other people too, but for me, the most amazing, heroic, galvanizing, spiritually uplifting public figure available anywhere on the landscape, and that is true to this day. If I see a tape, a film clip of his speaking in front of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, I mean, just thinking of it now, you know, I get the old bird leather, you know. So I get a charge from that, and I think that was a real and genuine hero in our society, a spiritual well, and I that was renewed for me when I saw that documentary on the civil rights movement, Eyes on the Prize,
mm-hmm.
and then reading a couple of books on Dr. King.
Not that you need any affirmation from me, but it's a wonderful song. Let's listen to Shed a Little Light at 92.3 K-Rock.
Let us turn our thoughts today to Martin Luther King and recognize that there are ties between us, all men and women living on the earth. Ties of hope and love, sister and brotherhood, that we are bound together in our desire to see the world become a place in which our children can grow free and strong. before us and the road that lies ahead. We are bound and we are bound.
There is a feeling like the clenching of a fist. There is a hunger in the center of the chest. There is a passage through the darkness and the mist. And though the body sleeps, the heart will never rest. Of a fist. There is a hunger in the center of the chest. There is a passage through the darkness and the mist. Though the body sleeps, the heart will never rest. Oh, let us turn our thoughts today to Martin Luther King
and recognize that there are ties between us. Men and women living on the earth, ties of hope and love, sister and brotherhood.
At 92.3 K-Rock, that's Shed a Little Light from the new Moonshine album by my special guest this morning, James Taylor. James, launching a new album. You've done this. You've been here before.
That I have.
Is there still an excitement about it? Is there still? What are your thoughts and emotions going through this process?
Oh yeah, there definitely is excitement about it. I mean, it doesn't happen that often. In spite of the fact that this is my 12th or 13th or so album, it is. You know, it's the culmination of a lot of work, and you know, you send these things off into the world. It's you feel excited about it and hopeful for it, and about how it will be received and whether or not people will connect with it, and you also feel a little bit of dread and anxiety that it won't meet with any enthusiasm or approval. You know, I don't know. It's you feel a real mix of things when you send it out. And there's a point in the process where it goes from being extremely private to being a very public and marketed kind of thing. And you know, that's a reality of being a public in the media performer. You mm-hmm. know, and. Everybody deals with that in different ways. Some people are shattered by that process, you know, and other people respond to it and just love it when it's like surfing for them. You know, they just sort of thrill, and the thing gets out there, and they get to go out and sort of it represents them in the world, and they're proud of their baby, you know. But I feel both things about it. I get both ends of that. But bringing it to market is a whole other thing, and it's reminiscent, really, of what happens with somebody in the first place when they start making music, you know, I think, at least in my case, and a lot of people, I know people who sort of get into their instrument, into their music, and into a form of sort of personal self-expression, they do it away from the world. You know, if they had, like, social skills, you know, or were successful in any kind of social way, they probably wouldn't have the time to do that or bother to do it.
You right.
know? So it's often the product of some kind of, you know, to a certain extent, alienation, you know, to detachment from the world. And then this most unlikely person to become public, you know, this what you're talking about is somebody who is really quite bound to be quite a private person, then turns this thing over to the most public possible kind of process. And that initial happening when a guy who's 18, 19, 20 years old goes to market with his stuff, you know, that he's developed personally on his own, and it happens for that first time, that's the most sort of traumatic, cataclysmic transition that the thing's going to take. And the thing is to somehow survive that, you know, because it's a shock, you know, and you're going to have to learn to do that. I mean, ideally, I mean, that's assuming people pay attention and, you know, are interested or want to know in the first place. But then beyond that, you have to learn how to, now that your life and the nature of your work and your art has changed, you have to learn how to continue to be able to go back to the well somehow, back to the source, and continue to do it. And it's very interesting. You know?
I'd just like to say that in a very detached, analytical way, you just told the James Taylor story on the radio, my friend.
I suppose so. You know, I think that it's a bit precious to be, you know, reticent and reluctant about to having success. I don't mean to say that at all. I'm just saying that it's a very interesting process. And
sure.
We've seen some people who do it well. I think the Beatles did it extremely well. They probably had more of it than anybody ever has. And yet they survived it and continued after, like, their amazing baptism of fire in 66. They continued right up through Sgt. Pepper and Abbey Road and, you know, Let It Be, and to continue to, you know, put out amazing stuff. Revolver, Rubber Soul, you know, it just, every new album was an amazing step. And people like the Stones have managed to survive it, you know, with a few casualties. But then there are people like Elvis, I think. Although Elvis gave us a whole lot, it was sort of, there was a point at which it just ate him alive, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly the possibilities of what he could be in that amazingly sweet, present, you know, electric person that we saw in the first 2 years, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of closed down at a certain point.
Yeah.
And suddenly it was all Colonel Tom and Las Vegas and, you know, Hollywood, and it's still Elvis, and it was great, but somehow it had really suffered.
And it's not a happy ending. We want happy endings.
Right. We don't want endings at all.
Well, you know, I mean, that is another thing that you certainly have to consider. You know, careers have beginnings,
right,
middles, and ends.
That's right.
There is that juggernaut phase which you went through and thankfully survived and are now beyond.
Yeah.
You just seem to be in a terrific place about it. It's like it's back in your control again. Is that accurate?
Well, you know, we always make a mistake when we think we're in control, because to try to take control is to lose it, you know. The typical sort of saw about this, the typical line is to accept the things I cannot change, change the things I can, and to have the wisdom to know the difference. That's what one asks for, you know. So I think acceptance somehow is at the heart of it, and just sort of knowing when to let go of it and to, you know, you just do the best you can and know when it's no longer your job to try to control it and let it go. But I know what you mean, Pete. I feel like it's a good thing to be in this life, and I'm pretty at ease with being in my own body and my own, you know, frame.
Glad to hear it.
Yeah, me too.
Do you listen to your old records?
No, I never do. Once you've recorded them, you've really heard them, and occasionally you'll hear him on the radio or in a humiliating way on the elevator or something, you know, but that's right. And also it's great to perform them, you know. That's the thing I like to do with them, is to take them on the road and play them with the band.
Is there a quintessential James Taylor album? Is there one that sums up?
Well, I have my favorites, you know. I like Gorilla. I like That's Why I'm Here. And I must say I'm pretty fond of this one now that we've got out, New Moonshine. Okay.
Conspicuous by its absence is Sweet Baby James.
Well, no, that's great too. That's great too. I mean, that's certainly what most people associate me with, and it was my most successful album, I think. So, but I leave it out because I think that's the obvious one, and those other ones are kind of sleepers.
There is a young cowboy who lives on the range. His horse and his cattle are his only companions. He works in the saddle and he sleeps in the canyons, waiting for summer, his pastures to change. And as the moon rises, he sits by his fire, thinking about women and glasses of beer, closing his eyes as the dogies retire. He sings out a song which is soft but it's clear, as if maybe someone could hear. Good night, you moonlight ladies, rock a bye, sweet baby Jane. Deep greens and blues are the colors I choose. Won't you let me go down in my dreams and rock her by sweet baby James. Now the 1st of December was covered with snow, so was the turnpike from Stockbridge to Boston. Though the Berkshire seemed dreamlike on account of that frosting, with 10 miles behind me and 10,000 more to go. There's a song that they sing when they take to the highway, a song that they sing when they take to the sea, a song that they sing of their home in the sky. Maybe you can believe it if it helps you to sleep, but singing works just fine for me. Won't you let me go down in my dreams and rock up our sweet baby Jane.
James, just a couple of things to finish off with. There's no delicate way for me to get into this subject area except to assure you that I'm not being facetious or trying to be funny. I'm absolutely serious because I think it's an issue that affects a lot of the, more of the men in our listening audience, and I would like your perspective on it.
Okay.
Do you miss your hair?
Yeah.
Is that indelicate? Is it?
Yeah, no, it was a surprise. Yeah, sure. I miss it all the time. you know, there are a couple of things to say about it. My dad was, since I was born, was a bald man. Always used to cut his hair with a shaver, you know, one of those electric razors.
Right.
So always, and still is to this day. And I always thought of him as being a very handsome fellow. So my my references are good, you know. I don't but it's you know, I think that the culture gives us signals repeatedly that that's not necessarily the way to look, you know? So I guess I do have moments of wishing that you know, we were talking about acceptance before, though, you know, so
right. It's that's part of it,
you know. I was away for a while. I didn't tour for a while, and when I came back, I lost a lot of hair, and there was a couple of episodes where someone from the audience would say, "What happened to your hair?" You know, and once I said, "Well, I was doing a Pepsi commercial and I burned it off," or you know, because at the time Michael Jackson had done that,
right?
So I had to have my special glove on there. At another point, someone said that, and I said, "Well, you know, I had a dream, and in this dream there was a sort of a luminous fog surrounding me, and a voice came out of the fog and said, James, the Berlin Wall can come down, and the people of Eastern Europe can be free, but someone's going to have to make a sacrifice."
Oh, that's funny.
Anyway,
I mean, another oddity, of course, is that you can trace it from cover to cover. I mean,
yes, that's right.
Mudslide Slim.
There it goes. Yeah, you know, sort of a time lapse thing. You know, I mean, I suppose if it really bothers me, I'll get some hideous looking rug and sort of sneak around trying to keep the top of my head covered. But in the meantime, unless people actually tell me that it's very upsetting that they don't want to see it, then I'll just leave it the way it is.
No way. I think it makes a terrific statement about another one of those. It may not be romance. You get the point.
Yes.
James, there is a song on the album of traditional folk song.
Yeah.
I'm wondering why you did it, and if you'd do it for us this morning.
I did it because it felt good at the time. And I had known the song for a while. Mr. Grolnick and I had been playing it in at sound checks. Before concerts, and we developed a kind of a version of it. It's just an old love lament, you know. Sort of. Let me see. I better change my capo position here.
The water is wide. I can't cross over. And neither have I wings to fly. Give me a boat that can carry two, and both shall row, my love and I. There is a ship, and she sails the sea. She's loaded deep, as deep can be, but not so deep as the love I'm in. I know not how I sink or swim. Oh, love is handsome and love is fine, gay as a jewel when first it's new. But love grows old and waxes cold and fades away like summer dew. rainbow shall roll. My love and I, rainbow shall roll. My love and I.
At 92.3 K-Rock, that is a live version of The Water Is Wide, which appears on the just-released New Moonshine album by my special guest this morning, James Taylor. James, the purpose of this segment of the show is to give listeners a glimpse of a performing artist that they don't get in a newspaper or magazine interview, that they don't get from the artist's records or concerts. Thanks for fulfilling that purpose this morning.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
At 92.3 K-Rock, that's Frozen Man from the New Moonshine album by James Taylor, who'll be 44 on Thursday night when he performs at our Rainforest Foundation benefit at Carnegie Hall. This is Pete Fornital. My thanks to John Platt, Don McGee, Bill Cates, and Tom Conway for their assistance in this week's show. I'll be back tomorrow in the midday right here on the only station you'll need in 1992, the classic rock station, 92.3 K-Rock.